This morning, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The bad news is, after all of our study in the book of Job, we're introduced to a new character in chapter 32. By the time he stops talking, we've covered six chapters in our Bible. The length of these chapters in the biblical text is longer than 12 entire Old Testament books and is longer than 17 of the 27 New Testament books. The good news is we're going to cover all six chapters in this morning's message. And no, I'm not going to take all day to do it. I don't mean to downplay this portion of God's inspired word. Robert Shaper observes these six chapters constitute a most interesting and provocative section of the book of Job. And yet my fear is, and really with the book of Job as a whole, it's possible to lose the forest for the trees, so to speak. You can get so caught up in all of the words that we miss the point. And I don't want to do that, especially in this message today. And so we're going to see this in an overview fashion. If you have the opportunity and the desire, I would encourage you to read through these chapters on your own time. And maybe with today's message, you'll have a bit of a structure that will help you as you go through them to greater understand them. Now, the last verse in Job chapter 31 constitutes a major break. There at the end it says, "And the words of Job are ended." We had looked at Job's final defense in our last study, where he had dismissed the accusations of his friends. He had issued a challenge before God. "Why don't you come and set it straight? If I'm in the wrong, tell me. If I'm not, vindicate me. Do something." And I imagine Job kind of in a huff, saying, "The defense rests," and flops down on his ash heap there at the city dump. And what happens next is silence. We don't know for how long, but I want you to observe, Job is silent. He's done. He has said all he's going to say. He's finished. His three friends are silent. They're appalled that Job could speak so boldly to God and about God. They're just basically sitting back and waiting for God to come in judgment. My guess is that as they were there with Job, you could see them kind of inching back away, you know. Just in case the lightning strikes him, they don't want to be too close. But then we also see that God was silent. There was no fire from heaven. No voice spoke in divine wrath. I think the silence was probably God's eloquent answer to the three friends that they were wrong in what they had said about Job and really about him. But it was also a witness to Job that the creator of the universe is not at the beck and call of his creation. Just because somebody dares God to do something doesn't mean that God has to do it. You know, some of you have probably heard stories of the atheist that says, "If there's a God, let him strike me dead." And then when God doesn't do so, they say, "See, there's no God." Well, if God had to obey every challenge that humans made, he would probably have little time to do anything else. And besides that, at that point, who's in control? If we can manipulate God, he's no longer God. And God does not respond immediately to Job's challenge. He too is silent. So chapter 32 introduces a new character. His name's Elihu. Scholars are pretty divided about how to take this guy. Robert Shaper calls this chapter in his book, Enterprising Elihu. Chuck Swindoll entitles his, Another Long-Winded Monologue, describing Elihu as Job's fourth friend who steps out of the shadows and talks too long, saying too little. Jewish scholar Robert Gordas heads his chapter in this part of the book, Elihu the Intruder. And the book seems to bear out such a nickname because you'll notice when Elihu is done speaking, he's never mentioned again. The term that comes to my mind, though, when I think of Elihu is the word enigma. Now, if you're not sure about that word, it means a person or thing that is mysterious, puzzling, difficult to understand. Philip Yancey, in his excellent book, Disappointment with God, refers to enigmatic Elihu. And that's what I've chosen as the title of this message. Another scholar agrees, saying, Elihu is rather of an enigma. He blusters onto the stage as an angry young man, full of his own importance, offering to clarify the situation for Job and his friends, angry with the muddle that they've gotten themselves into. In one respect, he's much like a comic turn, for he manages to spend a lot of time saying not very much. He covers much of the ground of the other friends while supposedly saying something new. He claims to say more than the other three friends have already said, and this is certainly true at the beginning of his speeches, but the middle speeches are cold and disappointing, a lapse into moralism which seems very hard on Job. Perhaps in these middle speeches, Elihu is setting himself up as sort of an arbiter between Job and God. Perhaps he sees himself in a courtroom trying to argue a case as coolly and as dispassionately as he can. He's trying to set out arguments for and against from the perspective of a detached observer. Elihu blusters away, making his own mistakes. But in the middle of the blustering, there are some gems. And it is these gems which are part of the preparation Job needs, and we readers need, to be ready to hear the Lord. I'm not really sure how to take Elihu. If he's a bit of a mystery, it's because he's very insightful one moment, very insipid the next. Sometimes he can be very pointed with insight, and thereafter rather dull. It's hard to really get a handle. What role does he play here? Now, there are some that believe that his four speeches that spread out over these six chapters were added later. The book of Job was written, and then somebody decided to insert this. But I think those arguments, while they're pretty academic, are pretty weak. And I think they are a part of the original story. I really do believe that Elihu has an important role to play. You just kind of have to dig through all of the verbiage to get there. Some say this is kind of breathing space in between Job's final defense and when God comes and speaks to Job. But I think there's something more to it. Elihu is different, as we're going to see. He's not just one of the other three friends. He pays more attention to what Job has said. You know, when we talked about the other three, you wondered sometimes if they were even listening to what Job had to say. They were there to make their point. Elihu is a better listener, and he approaches the problem differently. He seems to be more courteous than the other friends, although at times he can be a little pointed. And he undoubtedly surpasses all of the other three friends in his spiritual grasp. He introduces some new insights that are valuable. So unless somebody call me a 21st century Elihu, let's move on. We're introduced to the identity of Elihu in Job 32, beginning in verse 1. So these three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But Elihu, son of Barachel the Buzite of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. He was also very angry with the three friends because they had found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him. Now Elihu had waited before speaking to Job because they were older than he. But when he saw that the three men had nothing more to say, his anger was aroused. You see more about Elihu mentioned than the other characters here. We're told about his family lineage and where he's from. Unlike the names of his three friends, which have Edomite or South Semitic source names, most of Elihu's family name is Hebrew in origin. Ram is one of the ancestors of David when you go through the genealogies later on in Ruth and 1 Chronicles. Buzz is the brother of Uz. Well, of course he was. But he was a nephew of Abraham in Genesis 22:21. Now the locations mentioned are of Arab locations according to Jeremiah 25. So it does fit into the time frame and the locale of what we've looked at before. What you see here is Elihu comes in as an angry young man. He's younger than the others. He's full of energy. He's actually quite upset at everybody. He's angry at Job because Job dares to speak the way he does about God. He's angry at the three friends because they keep condemning Job, but they really have no basis. He looks at them all and says, "You've all missed the boat. You've all missed the point." He also says down in verse 18 of chapter 32, "I am full of words," and that's something nobody would argue. He is full of words, and he's a bit full of himself too, you will see as he comes through. But this is who he is. He's a younger man. He has probably sat back and watched this whole dialogue going back and forth between the three friends and Job. He's listened to Job's final arguments and his final challenge to God to come and answer these questions that he has. And in the courtesy and etiquette of the day, he has sat back in silence. He's held his tongue because younger people didn't interrupt older people back then. You just didn't do that. But when he finally realized that everybody's done talking, now he steps in. So let's look at the ideas of Elihu. Now, understand that in these six chapters, Elihu delivers four speeches. The first covers chapters 32 and 33. The second is chapter 34. The third is chapter 35. The fourth is chapters 36 and 37. He's more effective at the beginning and the end than he is in the middle. Frankly, he gets a little dull and boring in the middle. But he does make some points that are worthwhile. Initially, Elihu practically apologizes for even speaking. Take a look at verses 6 through 9 there in chapter 32. "So Elihu, son of Barakel the Buzzite, said, 'I am young in years and you are old. That is why I was fearful, not daring to tell you what I know. I thought age should speak, advanced years should teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in a man, the breath of the Almighty, that gives him understanding. It is not only the old who are wise, not only the aged who understand what is right.'" And at this point, he has a point, a legitimate one. Age is not a guarantee of wisdom. The folly of age is to presume that it is wise. Just because you grow older does not necessarily mean you grow wiser. The prophet Joel had prophesied that when the Holy Spirit would come in power, it would be upon the young men as well as the old men. And you saw that fulfilled on the day of Pentecost. Even Jesus accomplished his work on earth at a relatively young age. If wisdom is open to truth and readiness to learn, it would follow that age is more eager to learn from youth than vice versa. But it's not always the case. Frequently, youth possesses the wisdom of courage and the insight of innovation that has been lost by their elders. So Elihu comes out and says, I've respected you because of your age and your experience. However, that's no guarantee of wisdom. And what he points to as the source of wisdom is not human experience and intelligence, but the Spirit of God. Where the Spirit of God is, you have wisdom. And that is the perspective from which he speaks. Now, in fairness, Elihu communicates some excellent points. First, he points out that God disciplines a person to turn him from the error of his way. That principle is as timeless as it is true. God never wastes tests that we go through. The difficulties we go through in life can teach us. There is a learning possibility if we are open to be taught. And whenever God bears down on our lives, he has one goal, and that's to turn us back to himself. We're going to see in these speeches something that has not been brought up yet, and that is that the suffering we encounter in life can have a restorative, it can be positive if we allow it. All of the other things that have been said by Job and by his friends is that suffering is simply proof that you're sinful. And God is mad at you, and so now he's sending all this suffering. Elihu brings a whole different perspective and says, wait a minute, pain and suffering can have positive benefits if we're open to them. Secondly, Elihu insists that God governs justly. God is fair. God is sovereign. He's in control. He's not only good all the time, he's in control all the time. And God doesn't always feel obligated to explain himself. That's one of the things Job keeps insisting on. God, you better explain this to me. God doesn't have to. And oftentimes he doesn't. And then third, another important truth proclaimed here is an insight into the purpose of suffering. Specifically, God can sometimes send suffering not because we have sinned, but to keep us from sin. There are times when God will throw obstacles in our path, not because we've done something wrong, but to keep us from doing something wrong. And again, this is a perspective we haven't heard so far in the book. Now, you go into the New Testament, Paul speaks in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 about the thorn in the flesh. You've probably heard of that, right? You've heard of the thorn in the flesh Paul had to deal with. Do you know why he had to deal with that? Was it some kind of punishment because he had done something wrong? No, it was not. But if you read the passage, Paul says, to keep me from becoming conceited, God sent this thorn in the flesh. It wasn't because Paul was guilty of pride. It was to keep him from becoming proud. And sometimes God will allow things to enter our lives, not because we've been wrong, not because we've done something bad, but to keep us from evil. Again, a new perspective that we have not seen or heard yet in the book of Job. C.S. Lewis wrote an excellent little book called The Problem of Pain. And in it he says, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And there are times when the only way God can get through to us is to put us flat on our back. Sometimes the only way he can get our attention is to bring us through a difficult stretch in our lives. He can use pain and suffering to warn us, to humble us, to bring us to a place of submission. That's what Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 11 are all about. It's not always because it's punishment. It's not always God's justice that's on display. Sometimes it's His love. He is graciously keeping us from problems we could get ourselves into. And so this is kind of the introduction to what Elihu has to say in these first speech. Now, in contrast with what he had said initially, the second speech in chapter 34 is a little disappointing. He starts to sound more like his friends. You get kind of the old rehash of these ideas that had never gone anywhere before. I will give Elihu some credit, though. He doesn't try to embarrass Job. He's not giving details of his supposed immorality. He just wants Job to learn from this experience. Now, in this second speech, the central idea is the justice of God. We saw this was the driving force that provoked him to speak in the first place. You know, is God fair? And he deals with that in that second speech. One of the things that you find, and a lot of commentators have some trouble with, is Elihu's intensity. And he can be a bit brash. He can be a little strong in how he says what he says. And it's easy to mistake intensity for cruelty, for insensitivity, for arrogance. And Elihu gets blamed for those things often by the scholars. But I really believe that the intensity comes from these very strongly held beliefs that he has. He's really trying to warn Job before it's too late that the path that he's on is not good. The central fact of Elihu's second speech is actually correct. God is just. God is good. To say anything else would be to align ourselves with what Satan said back in the Garden of Eden, questioning the goodness of God. There are some superficial similarities between Elihu and the other three friends, but yet he does have something to add that is important. In the third speech recorded in Job 35, Elihu deals with the thorny issue of unanswered prayer. Job's been complaining, "Why won't God answer me? Why won't God respond? Why won't he come and speak to me?" And Elihu deals with that topic. Now, his answer seems or sounds a little bit thoughtless and heartless. He gives three quick reasons why God doesn't answer prayer. Pride, you see in verse 12. Wrong motives, in verse 13. And a lack of faith, in verse 14. And I'll be honest, these are kind of the quick pat answers we sometimes give to people. When they've been praying and praying and praying for something and nothing seems to be happening, it's real easy to whip these out. Say, "Oh, you don't have enough faith. Oh, there must be some sin in your life. Maybe you're asking with the wrong motives." Now, doesn't that just sound like Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar to you? So many times we can take on that role as one of Job's friends and quick to question, quick to accuse, quick to cause doubt. And I don't think that's our place. Yes, that's true. That's why prayer can go unanswered. And there are even more reasons than this. But none of them apply to Job. Yeah, that was the problem. They were so sure that, you know, Job was guilty of something, and Elihu kind of slips into that mode in these middle speeches. One of the problems we sometimes get into, and I've mentioned this before with the three friends, we like a God who is predictable. We like a God who is manageable. We like a God who's a formula. That if I say this and do this, then he has to do that. If I fulfill these conditions, God is going to do this every single time. And it just doesn't work that way. God is sovereign. He is in control. He is God. We do not tell God what to do. We cannot put God in a box and say, all right, God, now you got to come this way. It's not like that. C.S. Lewis made a similar point in his classic book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Any of you familiar with that? It's the first book of what's called the Chronicles of Narnia. And it's really written for children. He depicts Aslan as a lion who is really the Christ character. And there's a lot of childlike fantasy in it, but he tells the story, really, of the Bible. And in the story, Mr. Beaver is explaining about Aslan the lion. And he warns him. He says, he'll be coming and going. One day you'll see him and another day you won't. He doesn't like being tied down. And of course, he has other countries to attend to. It's quite all right. He'll often drop in. Only you mustn't press him. He's wild, you know. He's not a tame lion. Think about that when you think about God. God is not a tame God. God has not been domesticated by anybody. We cannot put God in a box and say, okay, God, now you must do this and you can't do that. And that's a bit what these folks have done, even Elihu. I think his God is too tidy. His God is too small. If we could borrow the phrase from J.B. Phillips' book, your God is too small. And too often that's true of us too. We like a God we can comprehend, that we can understand, that we can, if we are really honest with ourselves, manipulate. A God who will do what we want. Instead of praying for his will to be done on earth, we're praying that our will be done in heaven. And one of the things we're going to see in our next study, when God finally does show up on the scene, he's going to make it very clear, nobody tells me what to do. Now in his final address, Elihu rises above the petty notions of Job's three friends, and makes really what is his most impressive speech of all. The concluding statement, it includes his best and most distinctive ideas. In those middle chapters, he's kind of treading over familiar ground, repeating largely the ideas of Job and his friends that we've heard before. But in chapter 36, you see a more mature, a more engaging, and a very clear and orthodox statement of theology. What he says about God in these last two chapters of his speaking is right on the money. And it is very, very helpful, very beneficial. There's some new insight here. In Job chapter 36, if you turn over a couple of pages, Job 36 verse 15. But those who suffer, he delivers in their suffering. He speaks to them in their affliction. So often we get so caught up in the circumstance, we lose sight of what God is doing within it. There is, as Martin Israel calls, the pain that heals. And there can be a greater positive purpose in suffering when it brings us back to God. Israel writes, it is one of the fundamental contributions of pain to make people wake up to the deeper quality of existence and to seek evidence for the meaning of their lives beyond the immediate sensations that arrest their attention. Again, God uses pain sometimes as his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Hey, people, there's more to life than this. There's more to life than the bigger house and the newer car and the fatter bank account and the job promotion and all the stuff we get caught up in our lives that make us forget about God, that make us forget about eternity. And oftentimes, God has to get our attention, and sometimes that's a painful experience, because that may be the only way he can. But it's not because he's angry. It's not because he delights in sending judgment. It's because he wants to get our attention. He wants to speak to us in that suffering. He wants to draw us back to himself. Now, after a rather theological summation in chapter 36, Elihu looks up in chapter 37. It's all about God. In fact, that would be my subtitle for chapter 37. It's all about God. Kind of the flip side of the opening statement of the book, The Purpose-Driven Life. It's not about you. It's all about God. And if nothing else, Elihu is beneficial in our study of Job because he gets us looking upward. So much of our lives we spend looking around, we look within. We're focusing on ourselves, we're focusing on our circumstances. Elihu says, look up. Look up and you'll find the answers you seek. If the outlook is dark, try the uplook. And this brings us to the importance of Elihu. I think we have to admit that Elihu has an important role to play. He has more speeches than any of the other people. He is not interrupted as he speaks. There's no answers from the other people. His speeches are in a very critical point of the book. And some have pointed out, and I'm beginning to agree with them, that maybe Elihu's purpose in the story of Job is very similar to John the Baptist, who prepared the way for Jesus to come. And Elihu is preparing Job and preparing the friends for God to come on the scene, as we will see in our next study. He's getting their eyes and their ears focused to the right direction. The answers we seek are not found in ourselves. They're not found in others around us. They are only found in God. And we need to be looking up if we want to see the truth. Two attributes that Elihu really emphasizes in his speeches are God's justice and sovereignty, and yet he also points out God's love and mercy. You see in chapter 37, verse 13, his provision for creation shows that he's gracious and merciful. He gives life to humanity, in chapter 34. He forgives and restores. He delivers the sufferers in their suffering. He speaks during those dark days. He seeks intimacy with us when we are in pain. See, Elihu has pointed us to God. Job and his friends have been looking for an answer, looking for a cause to all this calamity. But all the searching has proved useless. They had no answer for Job, and frankly, Job didn't have an answer either. The answer comes not only in looking back, in looking within, looking around, but looking up. See, Job had done those first three things. We talked about that last week. He looked back at the past. He looked around at his present circumstances, he looked within. The one thing he didn't do was look up. And that's what Elihu is telling us. Elihu says, fix your eyes on the Lord. That's the only way things are going to make sense. And we see that the suffering in our lives can have a very positive, can have a benefit to us when we turn back to God. Job would later say in Job 42:5, "My eyes had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you." And I think one reason he could say that is because Elihu had prepared him for it. He was getting his perspective where it needed to be. I think Elihu is a bridge in the book of Job, stretching from the inadequate theology of a detached God, a God of power, of might, of justice, but detached from human pain and experience, to the wisdom of seeing God for who he really is. Yes, he's a God of holiness and justice and wrath, but he's also a God of love, of mercy, of grace. We see a fuller picture of God here than we have anywhere else in the book. We are brought again to the fear of the Lord, a way of living before God in obedience and dependence upon his grace. Taking God seriously. That's what it's all about. Yes, Elihu is an enigma, a mystery, much like the God he prepared Job to hear. Like John the Baptist did for Jesus, Elihu prepared the way for God to appear and to speak. And I think if there's anything that we can take from these messages of Elihu, it's really summed up in the chorus that we sang earlier. Maybe that would be a good way to conclude our service today. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Father, there are times in our lives where we get so caught up in what's happening around us, what's happening within us, what's happening to us, we fail to see the bigger picture. Help us to turn our eyes to you, that we might see the world as it truly is, that we might see you as you truly are. A God who is always in control, a God who runs the universe by your holiness and your justice, and yet a God of grace and mercy and love. May we fix our eyes upon you as you guide us through this maze we call life. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.